Beshwayo had moved his kraal 50 miles further downriver, but Bakat had no difficulty in leading them directly to it, for every footpath and all the cattle tracks fanned out from it like the strands of a web, with King Beshwayo, the royal spider, at the centre. The lush and rolling grasslands through which they rode were heavily populated by his herds. Regiments of the king's warriors were guarding the cattle. Many had fought with Jim against the Amahin. They all knew that Beshwayo had made him his blood brother, and their greetings were enthusiastic. Each regimental Induna detached 50 men to join the escort that led the wagons towards the royal kraal. The swiftest runners raced ahead to alert the king of their imminent arrival. Thus Jim's entourage was several hundred strong by the time they crossed the last ridge and looked down into the basin of hills where Beshwayo's new kraal stood. It was laid out in an enormous circle, divided internally into rings within rings like an archery target. Jim guessed that it might take even Drumfire almost half an hour to gallop around the outer circumference. The kraal was surrounded by a high stockade, and at its heart was a vast cattle pen in which all the royal herds could be contained. Beshwayo liked to live close to his beasts, and he explained to Jim how the inner enclosure also served as a fly-trap. The insects laid their eggs in the fresh cattle dung, where they were trodden under the hooves of the milling herds and could not hatch. The outer circles of the kraal were filled with the closely spaced beehive huts that housed Beshwayo's court. The king's bodyguard lived in the smaller huts. The larger huts of the king's numerous wives stood within an enclosure of woven thorn branches. In a separate smaller enclosure were 50 elaborate structures that housed the Indunas, Beshwayo's councillors and senior captains, and their families. All these were dwarfed by the king's palace. It could not by any stretch of semantics be called a hut. It stood as tall as an English country church. It did not seem possible that sticks and reeds could have been built up so high without collapsing. Every single reed used in its construction had been selected by the master thatchers. It was a perfect hemisphere. "It looks like the egg of the rock," Louisa exclaimed. "See how it catches the sunlight."
"What's a rock, ma?"
demanded George from the sling on his father's back.
"Ain't it the same as a stone?"
He had picked up that form of negative from his grandfather and clung to it stubbornly, despite her protests.
"A rock is a huge and fabulous bird," Louisa answered. "Can I have one, please?"
"Ask your father," she smiled sweetly at Jim. He pulled a wry face. "Thank you, Hedgehog. No peace for me for the next month." To distract George, he touched Drumfire with his heels and they trotted down the last hill. The escorting warriors burst into a full-throated anthem of praise to their king. Their voices were deep and melodious, stirring the blood with their magnificence. The long column of men, horses, and wagons snaked down across the golden grassland, the warriors keeping perfect step. Their headdresses waved and nodded in unison. Each regiment had its own totem, heron, vulture, eagle, and owl, and they wore the feathers of their clan. Around their upper arms they wore the cowtails of honour, awarded by Beshwayo for killing an enemy in combat. Their shields were matched, some dappled, some black, others red, while a few of the elite regiments carried pure white ones. They beat upon them with their assegais as they approached the kraal across a parade ground. At the far end of this wide expanse, the imposing figure of Beshwayo waited for them, seated on a carved ebony stool. He was stark naked, displaying to all the world the proof that the dimensions of his manhood exceeded those of any of his subjects. His skin was anointed with beef fat, and he shone in the sunlight like a beacon. The captains of his regiments were drawn up behind him, his Indunas crowned with the rings of authority on their shaven heads, his witch doctors and his wives. Jim reined in and fired a musket shot into the air. Beshwayo loved to be saluted thus, and he let forth a bull bellow of laughter. "Ha! I see you, Somoyo, my brother," he shouted, and his voice carried 300 yards across the parade ground. "I see you, great black bull," Jim shouted back, and urged Drumfire into a gallop.
Louisa pushed Trueheart up alongside him. Bechuaio clapped his hands with delight to see the horses run. In the sling on his father's back, George was kicking and struggling with excitement to be free.
"Beshi!" he yelled. "My Beshi!"
"You had best let him down," Louisa called across to Jim, "before he does you or himself an injury." Jim hauled the stallion to a skidding halt on its haunches, lifted the child out of the sling with one hand, and leaned out of the saddle to lower him to the ground. George took off at a run, straight at the great bull of earth and the black thunder of the sky. King Bechuaio came to meet him halfway, picked him up and hurled him high into the air. Louisa gasped and closed her eyes in trepidation, but George shrieked with delight as the king caught him before he hit the ground and sat him firmly upon his gleaming muscular shoulder. That night Bechuaio slaughtered 50 fat oxen, and they feasted and drank huge clay pots of frothing beer. Jim and Bechuaio boasted and laughed and told each other amazing tales of their feats and adventures.
"Manatasi," Bechuaio encouraged him, "tell me again how you killed her. Tell me how her head sailed up into the air like a bird."
He demonstrated with an extravagant sweep of his arms. Louisa had heard the story repeated so often, for it was Bechuaio's favourite, that she pleaded the duties of motherhood as an excuse to leave the royal presence. She carried George, protesting sleepily, to his cot in the wagon. Bechuaio listened to Jim's account of the battle with even more pleasure than the first time he had heard it.
"Ah, wish I had met that mighty black cow," he said, when the tale was told. "I would have put a fine son in her belly. Can you imagine what a mighty warrior he would have been with such a father and a mother?"
"Then you would have been forced to live with Manatasi, the raging lioness."
"Oh, no, Samoya. After she had given me my son, I would have made her head fly even higher into the sky than you did." "Ha ha!"
he roared with laughter, and thrust the beer pot into Jim's hands. When at last Jim came to join her in the Cardell bed, Louisa had to help him climb over the afterclap. He collapsed on the mattress, and she removed his boots for him. The next morning it required 2 mugs of strong coffee before Jim announced dubiously that if she nursed him well, he might just survive the day.
"I hope so, my darling husband, for I am sure you recall that this very day the king has invited you to attend the Festival of the First Flowers," she told him.
And Jim groaned.
"Bechuaio drank twice as much as that infernal brew as I did. Do you not think he may have the good sense to cancel the festival?"
"No," said Louisa with an angelic smile. "I do not think he will, for here comes his Indunas to escort us."
They led Louisa and Jim back to the parade ground. The open expanse was lined with dense ranks of young warriors, dressed in all the finery of feathers and animal skin kilts. They sat upon their shields, silent and still as statues carved from anthracite. At the entrance to the great kraal, carved stools were set out for Jim and Louisa beside the empty stool of the king. Behind that, the king's wives were squatting in double ranks. Many were beautiful young women, and nearly all were in some stage of gravidity, from a gentle swelling to full bloom, breasts bursting with abundance, belly buttons popping out. They exchanged knowing smiles with Louisa and watched the antics of golden-headed George, their dark eyes swimming with the strength of their maternal feelings. Louisa sighed and leaned across to Jim on his stool.
"Does not a woman have a peculiar type of beauty when she is to have a baby?" she asked ingenuously.
Jim groaned.
"You pick the oddest times to become subtly suggestive," he whispered. "Think you not that one George is about all this world can stomach?" "She might be a girl," Louisa pointed out.
"Would she look like you?"
Despite the glare, he opened his eyes a little wider.
"As like as not."
"That bears some thought," he conceded. But at that moment there sounded from within the walls of the kraal a shattering fanfare of kudu horn trumpets and a crash of drums. Instantly the warriors sprang to their feet, and their voices echoed against the hills with the royal salute.
"Bayeti! Bayeti!"
The king's musicians came out through the gates, rank upon rank, dipping and swaying, flirting their headdresses like the courtship dancing of crowned cranes, stamping until the dust powdered their legs to the knees. Then they froze in mid-step, and the only movement was the ruffle of the feathers in their headdresses. King Beshwayo paced out through the gates. He wore a simple kilt of white cowtails and war rattles on his ankles and wrists. His head was shaven, and his skin had been polished with a mixture of fat and red ochre clay. His tread was stately. He shimmered like a god as he walked. He reached his place and looked upon his subjects with such a terrible mien that they shrank before his gaze. Then, suddenly, he hurled the spear he carried into the air. Driven by his massive shoulders, it rose to an impossible height. It reached its zenith, and then, in a graceful parabola, fell back to peg its glittering head into the sun-baked clay of the parade ground. Still there was no sound. No man or woman moved. Then a single voice broke the silence. Sweetly and softly it rose from the riverbed at the far end of the parade ground. A sigh went up from the throats of all the assembled warriors, and their feathers danced as they turned their heads towards that sound. A line of young maidens came shuffling up and over the riverbank. Each one had her hands on the hips of the girl in front of her, and followed her movements with mirror-like precision. They wore very short skirts of combed grass and crowns of wild flowers. Their breasts were bare and shining with oil. They kept snaking out of the river bed until it seemed they were not individuals, but a single sinuous creature. "These are the first flowers of the tribe," Louisa said softly. "Each one has seen her moon for the first time, and now they are ready for marriage." The girl who led the line of dancers reached the end of the first verse of the song, and all the others came in together with the chorus. Their voices soared high, then fell and languished, and rose again, achingly pure, cleaving the hearts of their listeners. The line of dancing virgins came to a halt before the ranks of young warriors. They turned to face them, and the song changed. The rhythm became as urgent as the act of love, the words suggestive and lewd. "How sharp are your spears?" they asked the warriors. "How long the shaft? How deep your thrust? Can you stab to the heart? Will blood flow when you pull out your blade from the wound?" Then they began to dance again, at first swaying like long grass in the wind, then throwing back their heads and laughing with white teeth and flashing eyes. They held out their breasts, one cupped in each hand, and offered them to the young men. Then they retreated, and whirled away until their skirts flew waist-high. They wore nothing beneath them, and they had plucked their pudenda so that their unmasked clefts were clearly defined. Then they faced away from the men, and bowed over until their foreheads touched their knees, writhing and rolling their hips. The warriors danced in time to the girls, working themselves into a storm of lust. They stamped until the earth jumped under their feet. They shook their shoulders. Their eyes rolled back in their skulls and froth creamed on their contorted lips. They thrust their hips into the air like mating dogs, and their engorged sexes probed rigidly through the fur strips of their kilts. Suddenly, Beshwayo sprang high from his stool and landed on legs as straight and powerful as the trunks of two leadwood trees. "Enough!" he bellowed. Warriors and maidens, everyone on the parade, threw themselves to the ground and lay still as death. No sound or movement but the quivering of headdress feathers and grass skirts, the panting of their breath. Beshwayo strode along the ranks of girls. "These are my prime heifers," he roared. "These are the treasures of Beshwayo." He gazed down on them with fierce, possessive pride. "They are beautiful and strong. They are full women. They are my daughters. From their hot wombs will come forth regiments of my warriors to conquer all the earth, and their sons shall shout my name to the skies. Through them my name will live forever." He threw back his head and let forth such a volume of sound from the barrel of his chest that it rang and echoed off the hills. "Beshwayo!" Not another person moved. and the echoes faded away into silence. Then Beshwayo turned and strode back along the regiments of prostrated warriors.
"Who are these?" The question was filled with contempt. "Are these men who grovel before me in the dust?" he bellowed with mocking laughter. "No," he answered himself. "Men stand tall and are full of pride. These are little children. Are these warriors?" he demanded of the sky, and laughed at the absurdity of the question. "Ha! These are not warriors. Warriors have quenched their spears in the blood of the king's enemies. These are but snot-nosed children."
He walked down the line and spurned them with his foot.
"Stand up, you small boys," he cried. They leapt to their feet with the agility of acrobats, their young bodies forged to perfection by a lifetime of rigorous training. Beshwayo shook his head with contempt. He walked away. Then, suddenly, he leapt high in the air and landed with the elegance of a panther. "Stand up, my daughters," he shouted. And the girls rose and swayed before him like a field of dark lilies. "See how their beauty outshines the sun. Can the king allow those unweaned calves to mount his beautiful heifers?" he harangued them. "No, for there is nothing between their legs of any account. These magnificent cows need bulls of power. Their wombs crave the seed of great warriors."
He strode back down the alley between them.
"The sight of these young calves so displeases me that I am sending them away. They shall not look upon my heifers again until they have become bulls. Go," he bellowed at them. "Go, and do not return until you have washed your spears in the blood of the king's enemies. Go, and return only when you have killed your man and wear the cowtail on your right arm."
He paused and looked down on them with disdainful hauteur.
"The sight of you displeases me. Begone." "Bayeti," they shouted with a single voice. And again, "Bayeti, we have heard the voice of the black thunder of the sky, and we will obey."
In a close column they swung away, keeping perfect step, singing the praises of Beshwayo. Like a dark serpent, they wound up the slope of the hill and disappeared over the crest. Beshwayo strode back and took his seat on the carved stool. He was scowling hideously, but without changing his expression, he said softly to Jim,
"Did you see them, Samoyo? They are young lions and hot for blood. These are the finest fruits of any circumcision year in all my reign. No enemy can stand against them."
He turned on his stool towards Louisa.
"Did you see them, Welanga? Is there any maiden in all my realm who can resist them?"
"They are fine young men," she agreed.
"Now I lack only an enemy to stand them against." Beshwayo's scowl became even more terrifying. "I have scoured the land for 20 days' march in every direction and found no more fodder for my spears."
"I am your brother," said Jim. "I cannot allow you to suffer such lack. I have an enemy. Because you are my brother, I shall share this enemy with you."
Beshwayo stared at him for a long moment. Then he let fly such a bellow of laughter that all his indunas and his pregnant wives cachinnated in slavish imitation of him.
"Show me your enemy, Samoyo. Like a pair of black-maned lions on a gazelle, you and I shall devour him."
3 days later, when the wagon started back for the coast, Beshwayo went with them, singing his war anthems at the head of his new regiments and their battle-hardened indunas.